took it all in, washed it out, and gave it back to Jack with the most comfortable, trusting words of all. "I love you." They had big, bold dreams of a happy family. "With none of the crap I grew up with," Jack would say. Displaced dread. But once Jack got the job at Goldman Sachs, and subsequently left Goldman to start his own hedge fund, his anxiety genes fired up with a vengeance. Compensating for the fact that he'd grown up in a family without much money, he doubled down to make it. Mortified by their small, dowdy house and old furnishings, he tried many times to give his parents money so that his father could quit working. But Daniel always rejected his son's offer, saying, "I like what I do. If you're ashamed of me, I'm sorry." "Dad," Jack protested, "I'm the opposite of ashamed of you. I'd just like to pay you back for all you did for me."
"Then be a good man and lead a happy life," Daniel said. "That's all I want."
"You don't think I'm doing that?" Jack asked.
"You tell me,"
Daniel replied. That's where the conversation ended. The cryptic, "you tell me," just hung in the air. Daniel felt that to take his son's money would be to collude in an irreligious, workaholic lifestyle of which he disapproved. Once, when Daniel scolded Jack on this score, they had wound up not speaking to each other for 2 months.
"You pay too much attention to your work and not enough to your family," Daniel had chided. "For all the money you make, God knows you're not living your life the right way."
"Well, I'm making up for all the money you didn't make," came Jack's stinging reply. "At least..." Jack didn't say the rest of what he was thinking. "At least I make enough money to give my family a really good life." Injured, the two of them retreated into a chillier relationship. With no ice to skate on any longer, no locker room culture to buoy him up, no college buddies to drink with, Jack retreated into himself, which soon devolved into a hyper, driven, anxious person. Instead of reaching out to Nan, he behaved as if she weren't there, much as Joseph had taught him to do. He decided that college had been fantasy land. In the real world, as he called it, dog ate dog, and trusting someone resulted in getting eaten. The roller coaster life of a hedge fund manager filled Jack with worry that coursed through his blood. But because he could not understand how anxiety was crippling him, he embraced it. He felt naked and vulnerable without it. He believed in the common, albeit crazy, notion that if he were bold enough to enjoy a worry-free moment, fate, like Joseph, would let him fall down the stairs. But if he worried enough, fate would keep him safe. If Nan or a friend ever tried to remind him that he should take a break or chill out for a weekend at the house in the Hamptons, he would ignore them. For Jack, family vacations were always workations. Even when biking with the family, his mind was always on the markets. When he wasn't working, Jack truly didn't know what to do with himself. He felt something was wrong, that he was missing something, or that he was near failure. Worryholism. Jack could not see how fundamentally unhappy he was, and how unhappy he was making those around him. He thought he was on top of the world, but his anxiety led him to behave in precisely the wrong ways. He isolated himself and grew increasingly distant from Nan. Convinced that he was serving their shared dream of creating the happy family, he lost the central focus of their family life together. All but addicted to toxic worry, Jack played a psychological trick on himself. He decided to think of his anxiety as something positive. He only felt comfortable when he was riveted to some worry or another. Without the painful comfort of anxiety, he felt vulnerable. So he courted worry as pain of worry focused him. So intense was his desire to achieve, and so intense was his fear of the consequences of not achieving at the very highest levels, that he felt compelled to throw himself into work completely and arm himself by anticipating everything that could possibly go wrong. afraid to feel the real pain of how empty his life was becoming, he redoubled his focus on work. While Nan looked on with growing dismay and finally distance, she gradually lost her ability to scoop him up and hold him. He'd grown too big and too powerful to hold, too fixed in his view of the world as a punishing, dangerous place. For a while, she hoped she could bring back the man she'd fallen in love with, until that morning when hope went dark and she left. Toxic worry, the tendency to focus excessively on problems that aren't all that important, is common in the millions of people today who perceive all the dangers in life but lose sight of the positive. They are driven to distraction by worry. This problem is so prevalent that I wrote a book about it, Worry, Hope and Help for a Common Condition, published in 1998. Since then, due to various modern issues I've mentioned, the problem of toxic worry has mushroomed. It's become our ambient noise. Jack's tendency to worry had a genetic origin, exacerbated by the environment he chose to work in. Over the past 20 years, research has revealed a basis in our DNA for all moods and emotions, including worry. Jack was born with anxiety genes. Scientists have identified a genetic variant that contributes to a heightened susceptibility to environmental stress of the kind his father and grandfather experienced. In addition, another genetic variant can create an inborn susceptibility to the negative moods Jack all but courted. It has long been known that depression and toxic worry can spring from a genetically inherited lack of the powerful mood-stabilizing neurotransmitter serotonin in the brain. Hence, the most commonly used medications to treat depression and anxiety, called selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors, or SSRIs, raise serotonin levels in the brain. But genes never tell the entire story. Even a trait as highly inheritable as height also depends upon environment. If you grow up in a dungeon and never see the sun, or if you eat a meager diet, you will never grow as tall as your genes otherwise could help you to grow. Jack was trained to worry. His grandfather tricked Daniel and Jack in a way that most would condemn as child abuse. But Joseph thought he was doing them a favor. "That'll teach you. Never trust anyone, not even the father and grandfather whom you love." The psychological damage of Joseph's trick and the worldview the family held in general produced in both Jack and his father the emotional equivalent of growing up in a dungeon, never seeing the light of day. Jack's genes combined with his experience to create a toxic worrier. Fortunately, environment intervened in a positive way when Jack got to BU. Under the influence of new friends, the hockey team, and removed from the dark influence of his father and grandfather, Jack learned to trust, to have fun, and even to fall in love. But later on, environment intervened a third time, when Jack found himself in the competitive world of Wall Street. Joseph's terrible lessons surged back into Jack's mind as his primitive brain allowed his genetic tendencies to rule his world. Worry and connected isolation. Millions of people share Jack's genetic predisposition to worry, but not all of these millions worry in such a toxic way. Because Jack believed he needed his worrying to achieve at the highest levels, he turned it, in his mind, into an asset, even a state he thought of as weirdly pleasurable. Modern life has created the conditions to draw out the toxic worry in anyone so predisposed. While a few fortunate people are equipped with happy genes that allow them virtually never to worry, and a few people are born cool as cucumbers and are destined to never get rattled, I've found that far more share Jack's genetic makeup. Furthermore, various elements in today's world and in the human psyche combine in the perfect storm of toxic worry.
today's electronic communications technology assists the worryogenic forces because it lets us saturate ourselves in bad news that is both instantaneous and constant. While none of us wants to hear bad news all the time, it grabs our attention much more quickly than good news and is always in plentiful supply. Life will never run out of bad news, and fear sells. There's big money in fear. Advertisers pay for eyeballs, and nothing captures a person's attention quicker than fear. Fear even beats sex. Hence, legions of creative people are committed to unearthing and distributing as much fear-fraught information as possible. Most important of all, we are living in a time of a unique paradox that I mentioned in the introduction. While electronics connect us more than ever before in human history, indeed, electronic connection is this era's defining and crowning achievement, we've been disconnecting interpersonally. We are losing sight of each other, literally. People don't talk face-to-face as much as they did 20 years ago. As Harvard sociologist Robert Putnam documented in his prescient 2001 book, Bowling Alone, The Collapse and Revival of American Community, and MIT sociologist and psychologist Sherry Turkle explained in her 2012 book, Alone Together, Why We Expect More from Technology and Less from Each Other, we tend to live in a state of what I call connected isolation. Connected isolation is my ironic term for the common syndrome we see today, in which people are connecting with each other and the world to the point of saturation, primarily through electronics, while suffering from a mounting, inchoate feeling of being more alone than they'd like to be. The modern state of connected isolation deprives people of the most powerful anti-anxiety agent ever developed, the human connection. My old teacher of psychiatry, Harvard professor Thomas Gutell, used to tell us, "It is fine to worry, even good to worry. Just never worry alone." Those words, "never worry alone," have guided me ever since. One of the major reasons our era produces so much toxic worry is that too many people, like Jack, are worrying alone. Any latent tendency they might have toward the toxic worry is activated by the world in which we live. Jack was not incorrect in assuming that today's world is dangerous, and that there is plenty to worry about. Life is maddeningly uncertain. Trusting anyone is risky. Downsizing, outsourcing, and lawsuits abound. The economy is tenuous, and global competition can make anyone feel insecure. But Jack worried far more than most people, and in a self-destructive fashion. He believed his worrying carried him to safety, while, in fact, it was distracting him from what really mattered. Jack came to see me when he began to feel deeply enough the pain of losing Nan and the kids. In working with him, I validated his legitimate worries, but then asked him to look at how he amplified and exaggerated them and pointed out how he was crippling himself with his habitual toxic worry. Since one of the best remedies for toxic worry is never to worry alone, I joined Jack in his worrying, but tried to cast it in a less menacing light. I also probed Jack about why he held on to worry so tenaciously. Why not let it go? For the same reason I wouldn't walk naked down Fifth Avenue. You think your worrying protects you? I know it protects me. It hurts you more than you realize. How do you know? Because I can see what you can't see. You're that smart? No. You're that blind. You think I'm stupid? No. In fact, I know you're brilliant. But you are blinded by what happened to you growing up, and what happened to your grandfather. He held on to worry, ironically, to create a feeling of safety. Only by living in a state of constant fear could he feel safe. I worked with him to raise this insight to the level of conscious awareness, and help him test the waters of adult life long enough to find out that it is safe not to live in constant fear. That took some time. Jack was also someone for whom I prescribed hefty daily doses of human connection, as well as physical exercise. In addition, he benefited from the selective serotonin reuptake inhibitor Lexapro. In general, these types of medications are vastly overprescribed. But Jack's worrying was so ingrained and toxic that medication, in combination with the other interventions, was indicated. It sped up the process toward health. He was shipwrecked, but didn't know it. I had to play the role of the fool with him and whisper in his ear what he did not want to hear. "You miss Nan and your kids." "Is that a question?" "No." "You're a son of a bitch," he said. "You're a son of a bitch," I replied. Long pause, deep sigh, more silence. "I really don't like you," he said. "I don't blame you. I wouldn't like someone who showed me my mistakes either." Long pause. Another deep sigh. "This sucks. I'm done with this." With that, Jack got up and left, his time far from up. At the appointed time the following week, he came back, and kept coming back until he learned how to change. Successful resolution of ADT caused by toxic worry can happen, especially when someone works as hard at solving the problems as Jack. As I did with Les, Jean, and Ashley, I apply the basic plan to Jack's situation and note the following dangers. 1. Energy. Worry and chronic anxiety drain mental energy much as an open window in winter drains heat from the house. Bringing worry under control automatically boosts mental energy. 2. Emotion. Emotion is the on-off switch for learning and peak performance. Toxic worry and chronic anxiety disable learning and prevent peak performance. 3. Engagement. It's impossible fully to engage if worry preoccupies a piece of your mind. 4. Structure. If you are intensely worried, it becomes difficult to submit to the discipline of any structure. You keep drifting back to your worry, as your tongue to a canker sore. 5. Control. In toxic worry, you give over control to the process of worrying. What to do about it? 10 tips for dealing with toxic worry. 1. Never worry alone. Toxic worry feasts on a solitary victim, but flees when two or more join together. 2. Get the facts. Toxic worry is rooted in lack of information, wrong information, or both. 3. Make a plan. Toxic worry loves a passive victim, but cowers in the face of a person with a plan. 4. If the plan doesn't work, revise the plan. That's what life is all about, revising plans that don't work. 5. Bring in the right experts. They're usually worth what they cost. 6. Regular physical exercise helps your brain reject toxic worry. 7. Meditation is also a superb shield against toxic worry. 8. Divert yourself by doing something totally unrelated to what you are worrying about. 9. Keep perspective. Remember how much you've worried about in your life and how little of it actually came to pass. 10. Work on what I call the basic equation of worry. Increased feelings of vulnerability combined with decreased feelings of power and control lead to toxic worry. So anything that diminishes your feelings of vulnerability or increases your feelings of power and control will reduce toxic worry. Chapter 5. Playing the Hero. How to stop fixing everyone's problems except your own. People who fit the category of ADT outlined in this chapter tend to agree with the following statements. I take on other people's problems at work as if they were my own. When I see someone at work in distress, I feel instantly compelled to help that person. I grew up taking care of people. It's just not right to see someone struggle at work and not do your best to help out. I'm too soft-hearted. I take on other people's problems too easily. People tell me I should be more selfish. I don't understand how anyone can say no when the job has to get done. I hate the phrase, "nice guys finish last." Guilt is a big problem for me. "How would your morale be if I fired all of you right now?" Stan yelled, his hands in fists, his face ablaze. The room went dead silent. Everyone stared at him. "Morale is now a luxury we can't afford," he shouted. "So let me invite you to shut up and go back to work before more people get fired." Stunned, the staff silently stood up and filed out of the conference room. In the hallway on the way back to their cubicles, they shook their heads and exchanged glances that said, "Can you believe that?" Stan remained standing in the room, not moving, his palms now flat on the conference table, his face in a fixed stare. Mary, the corporate vice president next to him, remained seated, saying nothing. Unlike everyone else on the staff, Mary felt her heart go out to Stan. She always sensed his moods. Though he was brilliant, he was also arrogant, and not psychologically astute enough to understand the origins of such fulminant rage. Like Mary, he had been at the company for a long time. But now, the organization was in transition, and Stan was taking the brunt of the pressure from the interim CEO, which Mary knew he was ill-equipped to handle. Rather than accept and manage the pressure, Stan started to attack the people who worked for him. "We're all under pressure, Stan," she ventured quietly. Stan shot his gaze over to her. "Well, obviously," he snapped. Mary believed she saw his eyes soften a little bit. She stood up and walked out into the hallway. She noticed that several people on the staff had doubled up in each other's cubicles, talking under their breaths. When she returned to her desk, Jennifer, the director of the Northwest Division, was waiting for her. "What the hell was that about?" Jennifer asked. "All I did was mention that morale has dropped. It's obvious to everyone. Why can't he deal with it? Doesn't he understand that we've all been on pins and needles waiting for this new CEO to show up?" "Yeah, that was far from helpful," Mary said soothingly. "But I can't blame him for feeling frustrated. He's been under a huge amount of pressure. He's been trying as hard as he can to do what's being asked of him. But now he's managing from the bottom up and from the top down. He's feeling squeezed in the middle. If you think about it, it's no wonder his fuse is short." "Well, so is everyone else's," Jennifer retorted. "He should start acting like a real manager and not like some foot-stomping 5-year-old child." Then she leaned over and said to Mary in a serious tone, "Competent people have been fired around here for no reason other than to make room for the new CEO's buddies. This environment has become untenable. I've had enough." Then she handed Mary an envelope. "I found another job. I'm handing in my resignation, effective 2 weeks from today." When Mary first took the job back in the mid-1990s, she could not have been happier. Landing the position shortly after graduating from business school, she learned fast. She was dogged, curious, and worked hard. Her instincts were sharp. Rising from her starting position as a marketing manager, she quickly climbed the ladder to become the head of corporate communications. The staff she worked with was dedicated, tight-knit, and well-paid, and they all respected one another. Then, beginning with 9/11, the recession that followed, and the implosion of the dot-com technology business, things began to slowly come apart. Big retailers began closing their doors. Annual bonuses shrank, and dollars dried up. The CEO, the bean counters, and HR began pecking away at marketing resources, insisting on cutting back on everything from travel expenses to administrative assistance to copy paper. Mary found that she and the others in corporate were having to work harder and longer with less support than ever. When the news came down that the company had been bought by a much larger competitor, the insidious merger and acquisition process began. Partners and managers from a large consultancy made their appearance. People began to avoid spontaneous conversation. They only talked to each other behind closed doors. Cliques formed. Gossip about office politics spread like weeds where it had never grown before. Hank, the revered CEO, was let go, pending the hiring of a new CEO recommended by the consulting firm guiding the merger. While people waited for the new man to arrive on the scene, more gossip spread. Would the new CEO clean house? Morale continued to plummet. People started losing interest in their jobs and worked half-heartedly, though they dared not come in late or leave early for fear of being singled out. They stayed at their desks, lackluster, unable to focus. Their bodies were present, but their minds were usually elsewhere. Every few hours, some colleague, wanting to share the latest gossip or cry on Mary's shoulder, would tap on the glass of her office door. She would sigh and wave the person in. She never even considered waving anyone away. After all, she was the staff's mother hen, a role she had played for years. Like Jennifer, Mary had begun sniffing around for other corporate communications jobs. But even the ones in faraway places were well below her level of expertise and pay scale. Besides, she couldn't quit. She brought in money her family depended on. Her husband, a self-employed contractor, didn't earn nearly enough to cover all their expenses. And since her son suffered from chronic asthma that often demanded trips to the emergency room, they depended on the medical benefits she got from her employer. Every day, she came home feeling more and more exhausted and worried. She and Doug, her husband, would argue. "Look, you're miserable and you're making us miserable," he would say. "Why don't you quit? You could go to work for a smaller company. You could do PR. Heck, you used to wait tables. Anything would be better than this." That pushback, of course, made her hit the roof. "I've spent my whole life in management. I'm good at my job. I'm not about to leave now and go wait tables. How could you even suggest that? It's like me saying, why don't you take a job mowing lawns?" Altruism and the curse of the toxic handler. Conventional wisdom, traditional psychology, and the laws of economics tell us that people act according to their own self-interest. Once pretense and hypocrisy get stripped away, each of us is wired to push others aside to get what we want. Humans are fundamentally selfish, or so the party line has it. In addition, our current era actually encourages selfishness, even glorifies it. Narcissism is in its heyday, on full display everywhere. First identified as a moniker for modern life by Christopher Lash in 1979, the narcissist has only grown more common since. Our current zeitgeist, or at least a portion of it, treats selfishness as a bona fide virtue. Gordon Gekko's line from the 1987 film Wall Street seems even more applicable today than then. Greed is good. Everywhere you go, you find talented takers who are all about themselves. The doltish, self-aggrandizing athlete or hip-hop star. The CEO who pockets an unconscionable salary while refusing to offer health benefits to hourly workers. The entertainer who bathes in money while refusing to pay minimal child support. The entrepreneur who brags about his ability to get people to waste money on goods they can't afford and will never use. Then there are the people who can't help it. Those who just seem to lack the DNA for empathy. Such folks seem untroubled by, and often unaware of, the suffering they cause by playing politics and stabbing backs. In the close quarters of departments and teams,
such toxic people can poison their organizations. As reporter, author, and social commentator Marie Brenner has said, "Narcissism is the polio of our era. We have no vaccine on the horizon." Some would argue that even deeds that seem the most altruistic are selfish, deriving from an innate desire to serve oneself. However, recent research suggests otherwise. It appears that some altruistic behaviors are built into certain species. The most spectacular examples come from ants, the other conqueror of the earth, as Harvard biologist and naturalist E.O. Wilson dubs these creatures, which are a million times more abundant than humans. Some species of ants routinely take on tasks that lead them to die sooner than other ants. The ant's altruism is genetically determined and irresistible. Free will does not factor in. While humans seem to possess some degree of free will, with a nod to the absolute determinist to insist we don't possess one iota, recent research shows that we sometimes choose to act against our selfish desires, sharing more with the ant than we realize. Many humans, while equipped with the ability to decide between a selfish goal and an altruistic goal, are genetically wired to focus their attention more on the needs of others than their own. A study in 2005 by Rachel Buckner-Melman and others used a questionnaire assessing the propensity to ignore one's own needs and serve the needs of others. Based on responses from 354 families, Buckner-Melman concluded that the genetic architecture of altruism in humans is partly built from genes that drive an altruistic behavioral pattern regardless of kin considerations. In other words, some people do have altruism built into their DNA. To satisfy the cynic, we can say that for the altruist, helping other people is pleasurable. As is usually the case from a neurotransmitter standpoint, the key player is dopamine. A squirt of dopamine gives you pleasure. The drug addict is an addict because he's found that his drug gives him that squirt. But the altruist may be an altruist for the very same reason. Doing something for someone else raises the dopamine level. Now that we can watch in real time the activity of the pleasure centers of the brain through functional magnetic resonance imaging, fMRI, it's possible to assess at the cellular level how much pleasure a person is feeling. In one clever experiment, Georges Moll and colleagues scanned subjects while they were making decisions involving charitable giving. In some instances, the subjects were asked if they'd accept money for themselves. Of course, they accepted the money and the fMRI registered pleasure. But then, they were asked to give 40% of what they were to receive to a charity. On the fMRI, those who chose to give the money away registered even more intense activity in the pleasure centers than when they received money for themselves. Hence, we see a biological basis for the words in the prayer of St. Francis of Assisi. It is in giving that we receive.
Enter Mary, wired to be altruistic. Using her inborn altruism, Mary handles toxic people like Stan with grace and skill. Coining the term toxic handler in 1999, Peter Frost and Sandra Robinson described the person who mediates between a toxic individual, typically in a high power position, and the rest of the world. Some examples: the prima donna's agent, who absorbs her abuse before it can do too much damage to her public image; the superstar athlete's crony on the team, who makes excuses for him to the world; the loyal lieutenant to the talented but arrogant CEO, who mops up the blood spilled day after day and bandages up the victims; the loyal grandson of the tyrannical mater familias, who finds ways to excuse his grandmother's contemptibly cruel words and deeds; or the right-hand man of the take-no-prisoners crime boss, whose job it is to make murder look like suicide.
hugely valuable in organizations of all kinds, as well as in families. Toxic handlers like Mary saved the group and its mission. While these people can't prevent the ongoing poisonous behavior of the individual they are handling, they prevent the poison from spreading too far. Without their interventions, the work of the group, whatever group it might be, would be jeopardized, if not destroyed. Where does such a valuable asset, a toxic handler, come from? I'm tempted, because of all the good they do, to say from heaven. But such an explanation won't do, because it is also the case that, as much good as these people do, they also can cause great pain to themselves and those close to them. While toxic handlers save souls, they also tend to wrestle with a unique set of internal issues. Psychological jargon dismisses toxic handlers as codependent or victims of the so-called Stockholm syndrome. I don't like using these terms because they are entirely pejorative and so leave out the positives, but certain elements of codependency in the Stockholm syndrome do apply to people like Mary. Mary could be defined as a vicarious codependent. She lives through the people she helps. She gains satisfaction in helping others reach the limelight while avoiding the limelight herself. In my experience, women are more prone to this pattern than men. Perhaps due to how they are socialized, many women feel skittish about taking center stage, so they use their wits to help other people get their names on the marquee. Indeed, it may be a male value to put more emphasis on individual achievement than on facilitating others' achievements. Who's to say which is better, being the star or being the one who made the star a star? Traditional, male, psychoanalytic, psychology regards the backing away from center stage as weak, guilt-driven, fearful, and altogether neurotic, an obsolescent term itself, while taking center stage as strong, confident, bold, and altogether healthy. But such traditional psychology, I could really say old-fashioned and outdated psychology, overly pathologizes humility, generosity, the desire to nurture and protect, and the overarching wish to connect rather than to achieve. Neither way is better. I believe it is important rather to acknowledge both ways as potentially healthy as well as potentially harmful. For example, the humble, nurturing connector can become what is called in the jargon codependent and can go to extremes, which is the case with the Stockholm syndrome. The Stockholm syndrome refers to the bizarre and thoroughly counterintuitive reversal of the hostility that hostages initially feel toward their captors. Rather than hate them, over time they can come to admire them and want to stay with them. The syndrome is named after a 1973 bank robbery in Stockholm, Sweden, where several bank employees were held hostage in the bank's vault for 6 days. To everyone's astonishment, the victims allied with their captors to such an extent that they refused help from the outside. Once the ordeal ended, the hostages actually defended their captors. What went on in that bank vault is actually as old as human nature itself, and was given a name decades before the Stockholm bank job. In her classic 1936 book, The Ego and the Mechanisms of Defense, Anna Freud, Sigmund's daughter, described what she called a defense mechanism, a form of psychological self-protection to which desperate people sometimes unconsciously resort in traumatic situations. Anna Freud, who psychoanalyzed children, suggested that by identifying with the aggressor, as she put it, a child defends himself against feelings of helplessness and vulnerability. The child identifies with and wants to remain close to the person who threatens him. In a breathtaking, utterly counterintuitive reversal, for which the unconscious is famous, hostility magically becomes a desire to affiliate. As Anna Freud put it, by impersonating the aggressor, assuming his attributes or imitating his aggression, the child transforms himself from the person threatened into the person who makes the threat. Freud was writing about her observations in the development of the superego of children, but adults can also use the same defense mechanism she so aptly named, identification with the aggressor. In its more generalized form, Anna Freud and psychoanalysts since called this defense mechanism reaction formation. In using reaction formation, the individual unconsciously defends against unacceptable feelings by consciously espousing their opposite. The most famous example in English literature is when Queen Gertrude speaks the line in the third act of Hamlet, "The lady doth protest too much, methinks." In the play within the play, designed by Hamlet to catch the conscience of the king, the fictional queen promises, should her husband die, never to marry again. Her promises betray to the perceptive Gertrude a desire to do precisely the opposite, as Gertrude herself did. Using such reaction formation, we see people who fear their own homosexual yearnings viciously condemning homosexuality. People who lack religious faith fiercely condemning non-believers. People who actually hate another person professing love for that person. People who harbor toxic envy condemning envy as a deadly sin. People who yearn to be rich condemning the wealthy. People who roil with sexual feelings condemning the life of the flesh. People who are titanically ambitious insisting they are content with what they have. People who feel wild rage professing equanimity. People who seek to kill professing pacifism. The difference between hypocrisy and reaction formation lies in the role of the unconscious. The hypocrite knows he is lying, but the person using reaction formation consciously believes he's a pacifist, while his unconscious steams with a desire to murder every day. Mary's backstory. Mary's version of ADT is most common among our kindest people, the people who truly want to help others even before helping themselves. Modern life, with its instant access to everything, makes it easier than ever to investigate and try to solve everyone else's problems. Aside from her DNA, Mary's skill as a toxic handler got its start in her family of origin. Her mother, Flannery, was a shy, devoutly Catholic violinist. She fell in love with an up-and-coming conductor named Devin David while studying at Tanglewood, the summer home of the Boston Symphony Orchestra, when they were both in their early 20s. Flannery thought she'd gone to heaven when Devin paid attention to her. The cognoscenti at Tanglewood dubbed him the next Lenny, giving him the affectionate nickname they reserved for their darling, Leonard Bernstein. Devin's star shined as bright as a star could shine that summer. That he was an avid womanizer and an obvious narcissist didn't bother Flannery in the least. She lived for his glances, his touch, his kiss. Devin simply and effortlessly swept her away. Their marriage produced 3 children in 4 years. Flannery gave up her career as a musician in order to take care of the kids, giving Devin the freedom he needed to fly high and keep up with a blistering concert schedule, which he gloried in. Like most narcissistic men, Devin flew into cataclysmic rages whenever he imagined himself slighted, diminished, ignored, or disobeyed. Devin routinely arrived home, ready to attack. A concert had one flaw. A flutist missed a note. One of 2 sons had left a toy in the foyer. Any trigger could set him off. When he raged, words quickly gave way to slaps and shoves, objects thrown, beatings, and sometimes blood. No one dared to do anything until Mary got old enough to get involved, which was at the age of 4. The eldest child, Mary learned to protect her siblings and her mother, first by cleverly learning her father's moves. She instinctively knew the semaphore that announced impending rage. A raised eyebrow, glasses being cleaned, a clearing of the throat at a certain higher pitch. a twitch of the left ring finger, an ever so slight decrease in volume of voice, a tiny shift in cadence in asking, "What did you say?" or even, "How was your day?" Any of these, and many more, could portend an eruption, which Mary learned to anticipate. Even as she learned the warning signals, this gifted child also learned the art of diffusing her father's rage. She learned that her daddy loved to be hugged about the waist, but not held by the hand. She learned that daddy would calm down if Mary did a cartwheel on the living room rug, but that he hated it if she struck a wrong note on the piano. She learned that he liked to hear her say, "I love you," but that he hated to be asked a question or be asked to do something. And as she got older, Mary's mother made her swear not to speak of the women Devon paraded around town with. Mary also learned, at age 5, how to be Devon's bartender. When he asked her to make a drink, she would get ice from the freezer, put it into the right crystal glass, pour scotch on top of the ice, and add just the right amount of soda water. At age 6, she learned how to make a martini, up with a twist. Not many 6-year-olds developed the skill of peeling a sliver off the rind of a lemon, rubbing it on the rim of the martini glass, and twisting its essence into the drink. But even more remarkably, she learned, most tactfully, how to regulate his intake so the alcohol would work its desired effect, which was to put him to sleep before he became violent. She couldn't have told you, if you'd asked her, how she managed to do all this, but she did it every day that he was at home. No one ever mentioned this life-saving talent of hers. Her mother and brothers sensed that to do so risked her father seeing through Mary's tricks, which would have resulted in devastation. Accordingly, they pretended they didn't see the magic Mary worked. Flannery had no doubt whatsoever but that God had given Mary this gift to mollify the devil in Devon, and thanked God and her daughter in her nightly prayers. When Mary went off to college, the family held its collective breath in terror. But fate intervened. Devon suffered a hemorrhagic stroke that left him paralyzed. He was no longer able to conduct or to assault. The toll of toxic handling. Mary's early wounds, inflicted by her malignantly narcissistic father, led her to become a woman with enormous generosity and power to heal others. Year after year, Mary practiced her unique art, gradually raising it to a rare skill indeed, a skill she was able to transfer into her handling of other people outside of home. Compared to her father, most other toxic people were easy to deal with. Her handling of Stan was just one in a long line of triumphant examples. But such triumph came at a price. Without realizing it, Mary gave too much of herself over to the well-being of Stan and the people she worked with. She lost the focus she needed to do her own job well, not to mention to care for her own family. Finding herself increasingly depressed and burnt out, she began feeling less and less well physically, despite her efforts to keep up with her regular gym visits. Her neck and shoulders hurt constantly. She had more and more trouble sleeping. Her doctor prescribed Prozac and referred her to a therapist. After a few weeks, Mary began to feel the effects of the Prozac. They muffled her fragile emotions a bit, but she lost all her sexual desire. She felt the Prozac made her less mentally alert. She never followed through with the therapist, but her doctor refilled her prescription and urged her to take it, saying that the drug was safe and effective. At least, the doctor reassured her, it's something. Sadly, she needed far more than that something. In today's world, bursting with conflict and narcissism, altruists like Mary often absorb and neutralize the poisons. They don't realize how at risk they're putting themselves and others. As I've suggested, women fall into this trap of self-sabotage through self-sacrifice more easily than men do, but kind and generous people of both sexes
in any walk of life are susceptible to it. People like Mary, who lose their focus due to altruism and an inborn, unstoppable sensitivity to others, make up a large segment of the population. We read every day about the opposite type, the talented narcissists who build empires but ruin the lives of people around them. When we do read about people like Mary, it's usually in a context of a human interest story or the pathological side of the coin, the codependent or the enabler. In this chapter, I've expanded the frame to show the strength people like Mary possess and the great good they can do. On the other hand, they often allow themselves to be taken advantage of. That's why toxic handlers need handlers too. Mary needed counseling not only for the sake of her marriage, but for the sake of her career, her physical health, and her well-being. Mary needed something better than the Prozac that her doctor reflexively refilled. She needed to understand both the advantages and disadvantages that come with her uncanny ability to read people and to make them feel good. Paradoxically, what saved her as a child led her to sabotage herself as an adult. We see it often. People behaving self-destructively in adulthood by enacting patterns that saved them in childhood. In addition to Mary, think of the child who retreated into a fantasy world to save herself back then, or the child who learned to lie artfully to avoid her father's sadistic attacks, or the child who learned too well how to please others to avoid danger, and how maladaptive those stratagems become in adulthood. To help Mary learn how to focus on herself rather than sacrifice herself for the good of the group, I had to help her defuse a fairly common, elaborately wired time bomb. As a child, Mary could not allow herself to feel how angry she truly was. She could not afford to feel anger at her father because she believed if she did, she and the rest of her family would perish. So she developed the habit of acting in the opposite way of what her deepest, truest feelings would have her do. My work with Mary took time. There is no quick fix for what Mary, or what the other five characters I discuss, wrestled with. We live now in an age of fast food psychiatry, which is about as nourishing as any fast food. People have grown impatient with long-term psychotherapy, or long-term anything, lampooning them as Woody Allen therapy. Ineffective, never-ending, self-indulgent. Instead, we rely on the most common psychiatric intervention by far, medication. Medication is fast-acting, painless, relatively inexpensive, and convenient. It often helps. As I have stated, I prescribe medication regularly. But I also know it never does all that needs to be done. We would do well to regain a respect for therapies that allow enough time for a person to change maladaptive patterns of behavior and, to use a turn of phrase that has gone out of fashion, to work things through. Since Mary's very survival and that of her family depended on her keeping her anger unconscious, it would require, first of all, the creation of a safe and trusting relationship with me before we could touch that anger. However, until we arrived at such a safe and trusting place, and indeed, while we were getting to such a place, I could and did coach her on ways to take care of herself while also taking care of others. Most of all, I helped her discover that, as an adult, it was safe now to let other people take care of themselves. No longer did she have to do it all. But all that took time. Like the other people in this book, she was desperate when I met her. That was good. The moments when we feel most lost, most near collapse, most vulnerable, are the moments when, with the right help, and with a touch of luck or grace, we can do what might have been impossible before. As William James observed some 100 years ago, most people live, whether physically, intellectually, or morally, in a very restricted circle of their potential being. They make use of a very small portion of their possible consciousness and of their soul's resources in general, much like a man who,
out of his whole bodily organism, should get into a habit of using and moving only his little finger. Great emergencies and crises show us how much greater our vital resources are than we had supposed. Forcing a person to dig deep is the good result of a crisis. In a crisis, we are most apt to wake up, shiver, and change. Of course, it is also when we are most apt to ruin our lives. Whether the moment of crisis veers one way or the other depends upon how the individual deals not just with the facts of the situation, but, more importantly, with the flames of emotion it creates. Put differently, the person bearing with the intensity of the emotions, rather than fleeing the scene or attacking some imagined enemy, determines the wisdom with which he or she can deal with the facts. The key to bearing with the emotions is to reach out to someone else, to never worry alone, as my old teacher used to say. Worrying alone, especially in a crisis, leads to disaster. But if you worry with the right person, the crisis can open you up and lay bare what's wrong. Intense emotion can rip a person apart, but, handled with skill, such emotion can serve as a scalpel that cuts open the psyche in a way nothing else can and allow for surgical cure. As José Ortega y Gasset wrote some 80 years ago, "Take stock of those around you and you will see them wandering about, lost through life, like sleepwalkers in the midst of their good or evil fortune, without the slightest suspicion of what is happening to them." Life is, at the start, a chaos in which one is lost. The individual suspects this, but he is frightened at finding himself face to face with this terrible reality, and tries to cover it over with a curtain of fantasy, where everything is clear. It does not worry him that his ideas are not true. He uses them as trenches for the defense of his existence, as scarecrows to frighten away reality. The man with the clear head is the man who frees himself from these fantastic ideas and looks life in the face, realizes that everything in it is problematic, and feels himself lost. As this is the simple truth, that to live is to feel lost, he who accepts it has already begun to find himself, to be on firm ground. Instinctively, as do the shipwrecked, he will look round for something to which to cling, and that tragic, ruthless glance, absolutely sincere, because it is a question of his salvation, will cause him to bring order into the chaos of his life. These are the only genuine ideas, the ideas of the shipwrecked. All the rest is rhetoric, posturing, farce. In crises, we find our ideas of the shipwrecked. We cut through the haze and, out of necessity, find what we need. Which Mary did. With Mary, and the many other people like Mary I've worked with, the greatest agent of change was the love that developed between the two of us. Love has become a dangerous word, sometimes for good reason. But for better or worse, love remains the most powerful tool for good we have in this life. Love between a therapist and a client is unique in that the two people see each other only in an office, at set times, for a set amount of time, and all they do there is talk. Furthermore, the focus is mainly on one person, the client. While the personality of the therapist certainly enters, the details of the therapist's life don't get much airtime, nor should they. What develops over time, when the process goes well, is a deep and abiding respect, care, and infusion of formative energy each person feels from the other. Call it love. It is a kind of love that has no exact duplicate elsewhere in life. Perhaps the closest to it is the love that develops between a person and a certain composer's music, a certain artist's paintings, or a certain writer's novels. It takes time for this love to reach a level where it can affect change. You get there through chit-chat as well as the discussion of big topics and important events. The process still mystifies me, but I have personally seen it work so often, both as a client and as a therapist,
that I know its power is real. When I am the therapist, I don't wield the power, nor does my client.